Welcome to On Par with Maury Povich. Today on Par, I'm talking with a fearless voice who's been breaking barriers in comedy for over three decades, and doing it, by the way, on her own terms. Margaret Cho has never fit into a single box. She never tried to. From stand-up, TV, to activism, to music, she built a career on evolving, adapting, and pushing back. Now, if there's anyone who understands reinvention, it's Margaret Cho. And so we're going right there. So, Margaret, welcome. I'm so happy here on par with me. I guess I can't even start to talk to you about anything without mentioning this mutual love fest between you and my wife.
She's an icon. She was representing Asian women and the possibility that we could do anything. She, of course, is so beautiful, so brilliant, so accomplished. And, you know, I can't overstate her importance for people like me, people who just didn't see themselves. We didn't see ourselves represented anywhere. And then to have somebody like her, who's just, she's magnificent in every way. You know, it's really incredible.
It's interesting, Margaret, because she talks about this and you a lot because of your success and what everything that you did to break through. And I know that in the last election, there was, you were very, very involved in the campaign of Kamala Harris. And you got Connie involved as well. What's it like to lose?
It's so disappointing, and I feel it so much every day, especially with what's happening now, you know, with the current administration and all of the unlawful, illegal, terrifying ICE raids. Just to name one thing, there's so many things, but we could have avoided all of this if we had an Asian woman in charge.
Okay. I understand your view, believe me.
Yes. Yes.
Now, here's the thing. You grew up in San Francisco. There are a lot of Asian Americans who grew up in San Francisco. Did you feel like an outcast, or did you feel like you were with your people?
In a lot of ways, I did feel like I was with my people. The invisibility and outcast feeling kind of happened probably was really looking at television and looking at culture in general, because you didn't see any Asians. You didn't see any. Every once in a while, there would be like a commercial which would have an Asian person. There was like a something about ring around the collar. And there was an Asian woman in that commercial. But there was like very few opportunities to see images of ourselves anywhere. So that's where you really felt like an outsider or an outcast.
Were there many other Asians doing stand-up when you started?
No, there were no other Asians doing stand-up when I started. So I was the first. There was one woman named Tamaya Otsuke. She's in L.A. at the time. I was still in San Francisco. And she was Sam Kinison's girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
And she would wear a full samurai armor on stage, which was very cool. And there's Johnny Yoon, who was from Seoul, from South Korea, of course. But he had moved back to Korea. He's sort of the Rat Pack adjacent guy, Vegas guy. But other than that, there were no Asian American comedians at all.
It's very interesting because my wife talks about this and she made reference to you. Back then, if you filled out an application, even if it was a medical form, it was, are you black? Are you Hispanic? Are you white? Or are you other? And all the Asians had to check other.
Right.
What was that like? Right.
Other was just like the only thing that was viable, you know, and it was like we didn't exist, even though we make up one quarter of the world, pretty much. There was no sense that Asian American was a real identity.
Margaret, you're an author. You're an actress. You're a stand-up comedian. What do you like the best of those?
I like doing stand-up comedy the best because you never know what's going to happen. It's really interesting. It's such an interesting job, and every day is different.
You told my people you bombed the other night.
I often will take. I do like it's interesting how. I'll take these chances and because I always try different material and I'll try new things and sometimes it doesn't go well. And usually I can handle it. I remember that night I started to really panic and I started to get this animal fear, which is very strange because I've been doing this for 43 years. So I'm very used to failure and success in all of its different forms. But this was a little bit different. I was really sort of taken aback and I couldn't get the audience for whatever reason. I couldn't make a break for it, because usually if I'm doing poorly I'll comment on the fact that I'm doing poorly and that usually will work, but
were there boos or just silence?
No silence and like startled, like mostly cringe. You know when we can feel people kind of moving in their seats, like ooh, uncomfortable, like they're embarrassed for you, which is really the worst because you want to really be able to have the power to shake all that off. You usually get to as an experienced comedian. But that's one of the things I love about comedy is that you really don't know. Your success over time has nothing to do with how you're going to do that night. You know, your fame will buy you like maybe 15 seconds of grace, but then you have to really deliver.
So
when you can't, it's startling.
Over the years, I've known some stand-up comics. And I am particularly close with two. Mm. One is Kathleen Madigan.
Oh, I love her.
And one is Lewis Black.
Oh, he's a genius.
So Lewis was on the podcast, and we were talking about this. And I know this about Lewis. I've known Lewis a long time. Mm-hmm. He told me, and I always thought there was a dark side to stand-up comics. I mean, that they would talk about their dark side and stuff like this. Lewis told me that in all his years, he never had any anxiety until COVID came along. Mm. And once COVID came along and he was holed up in his apartment, he got these fits of anxiety. Can you understand that?
Yes, because COVID was the first time that we comedians, and I love Lewis, I think he's such a road dog, like he's such a road comic. He goes and does shows every day all over the world. So it was hard for us to stop down after so many years as a traveling comedian to just not do that. I had the existential crisis of who am I? Like, what do I even do? Like, what is my purpose? I think that's what a lot of us felt.
You never thought that before? Once you were kind of isolated in this apartment or you're not able to see anybody and things like that?
Yeah, it was a real crisis. And fortunately, I discovered that I really love being home. I'm actually naturally a very happy homebody.
You never knew before?
I never knew because I never gave myself that opportunity.
But now you have cats and a dog. I mean, you got a lot of stuff going on.
Which I love. You know, I love my home life and I have a lot of plants. It's very satisfying.
So when you grew up, I guess I can't believe this. You were, I'm just laughing at this. You were a phone sex operator at the age of 15.
That's correct.
How did that go and how did that start?
Well, I had a friend who unfortunately is no longer with us, but sometimes you'll have a bad friend who will make you do things that you shouldn't be doing. Like I always had her. She always taught me how to smoke cigarettes and stuff like that. Like she was my bad friend. And so she got us this job where we were going to work for this phone sex line, but then we were better at recording messages than we were at talking to patrons. So we got moved to the recording booth and we would record these short messages that were phone sex line, like monologues, but
Like
they
what?
Were very you, they were you, simple get, simple English, like my name is Mary. I have blonde hair and blue eyes. I am 5'5" tall. I weigh 120 pounds. I am very sexy and I have large breasts. So they would assist people to learn English, but also who didn't have, I don't know, an interest in going to an ESL class, or they wanted to learn by practicing phone sex. So they would call our line and pay a dollar a minute or however long, and they would learn that way.
You've said that every single night you try to write a joke before you go to bed.
Yes. And every morning I try to do that. It's mostly in the morning now. Sometimes it'll be at night, but usually in the morning. And it doesn't have to be usable and it doesn't have to be funny. It just has to be an attempt at what is my, that's kind of like to reinforce the idea of my purpose. In sleep, you kind of like really kind of let it marinate in there, you know. But yes, I do. I try to write one every day.
You ever wake up in the middle of the night and write one?
Yeah, yeah. And that's really important too, because when your mind is like in that relaxed dream state, that's the most creative time. So it's important. I have like notepads all over. I have ways to record what I need all over my house so that I'm somewhat cognizant of like something may happen. Something may, you know, I have musical instruments all over my house so I can get up and like play something. If there's a melody moving through that I can get up and capture it. It's very important to do as an artist, because those things will fly away if you don't pay attention.
So I don't know what term you would like to use with your sexuality. You've been married. You've not been married. Some people have called you bisexual. You use a word called pansexual. Tell me what that is.
Pansexual is where your sexuality involves people of different genders and different identities. I would say for me, bisexual is limiting because I don't believe in a binary. I believe that gender expression and gender itself is infinite, so that there's many ways to define gender. But also people have also said bisexuality is my gender and whoever else's gender that might be different from mine. So that's also acceptable. So you could just say bisexual.
And when you were married, it was kind of like an open marriage anyway, right?
Yes, but it didn't really, it's sort of one of those things where it was like a experiment that didn't work so well. I think also for me, marriage doesn't work just because I don't feel like I want to be with just one person. I also don't want to live with anybody else. I think that's probably the most of it. I like living alone.
With cats and dogs and plants.
The best. Plants and sourdough starters and kimchi and all those living things that I love.
Right. When did you get the idea that you wanted to lose weight?
I have always been fat. So when I was a little kid, like when I was younger and a young teenager, when you're a fat girl, like for some reason, like the most beautiful girls want to be friends with you. And then you are forced to be their legal representation for the rest of high school. And so all the boys that like them have to come up to you and like give you proposals. You know, they're like giving you things like that they can give to the beautiful girl. Like it becomes very tiring. You know, I would like to be the center of attention at some point. Not that being fat negates that, but as a kid, I really internalized this idea of like not being fully human, because I was the wrong body size at the time.
But I remember you when you were starting out, let's say in the 90s and things like that, and you were doing a sitcom and things like that. You weren't worried about weight back then, were you?
I wasn't, but the network was. You know, the network were always telling me I had to be thinner. And that became my primary focus. And it's very hard, I think. I mean, nowadays it's a little bit easier with things like GLP-1s, but back then we didn't have that. We had, Entenmann's, and weird diet drugs, and nothing really worked. And so it was very challenging to be a smaller body for me.
But you've lost a lot recently.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, over the years, I've just kind of been able to sort of come to some sort of a peace with the way that my body is. And, you know, and that's good. Like, as you get older, I think we feel much more comfort in ourselves, which is a great thing.
Are you on the road much or not?
I am. I'm about to go on a big tour. It's called Cholagarchy, and it's all about today's political disaster. Very, very critical of it. And I'm very, it's a little bit like a Lewis Black thing. You know, I am as furious as he is. I'm sure he's furious.
But Lewis, you know, with Lewis, it's a pox on all your houses. You know, it's not, not one or the other. It's everybody.
Right.
I mean, that's the way Lewis looks at politics.
Which I love. I love. I love him. So I'm about to launch a big tour. I'm going to start in Provincetown, which is one of my favorite places, in a couple of weeks.
Where is
August
that?
1st is Provincetown.
Oh, it's in Provincetown. You're going to Massachusetts, right.
Yeah. So August 1st and 2nd it starts. So I'm really grateful.
Yeah. Lewis uses a bus. What do you do? Just fly?
I just fly. But what a luxury. A bus is great. A bus is like, it's like your suitcase and your hotel room in one. You know, you're just like in the bus and you're traveling. Like, that's a great way to live.
When you started out in stand-up, who were your favorites?
I always loved Joan Rivers.
Oh, wow.
Joan Rivers was the best.
I thought Joan, and I used to know Joan, I thought she was as quick and reactive as anybody I've ever seen.
Yeah. Incredible mind. Incredible lady. And a good friend, and also just a mentor. Also, Paula Poundstone was incredibly important, and still is. You know, I still really I follow her on Blue Sky. She's really an amazing, just amazing mind, just a brilliant, brilliant comedian.
Any men?
You know, Robin Williams I always loved.
Oh wow, yeah.
I always loved him.
Another He's San Francisco great, guy.
Yeah, great guy. Bill Hicks was an incredible guy. I got to work with him a lot when I was really young. You know, he was very important as well.
Is that it? No more acting? Just stand up?
Oh, no. I love acting. I would love to do more. You know, for me, acting is just as important and really exciting to be able to do. You know, it's something that I really have a lot of fun doing. So, yeah, I want to do more.
Do you think that you're politics hurts you in terms of your profession?
I don't think so. I don't think
so. You're pretty political. I mean, you've put yourself out there.
Yeah, but I just want fairness. I want equality. I'm like an old school Democrat. Like, I don't think that that's got to be controversial in any way. Like, you know, to me, that's a very... I think of it as very centrist, almost, you know, it's very rational.
You got a lot of problems in the Democratic Party.
It's true. It's true.
I don't know why, but I just get the feeling that they're all just floundering, looking for an answer.
Yeah. I think we're dealing with something so shocking. We didn't realize that we were going to deal with the blatant racism and misogyny, the absolute worst of the corruption, you know. So, you know, not to say like in the end, just the inept manner in which they do business. So it's a lot.
Do you understand how MAGA came about and has been so productive?
I think that it's people just want a spectacle. And they want to sort of react in a way that isn't well thought out.
You don't think that they're made up of people who just felt that they were underserved?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. That there's a sense of righteous justice. But the thing is, they're fighting against the wrong people to get that justice. You know, the problem isn't trans people. The problem isn't immigrants. The problem is we don't have universal health care. The problem is we have a system that's broken in a lot of ways, but is not serving lower and working class and middle class families.
How would you describe the city of San Francisco these days?
San Francisco these days is interesting because it's
because
very...
a lot of people who follow Donald Trump say that's the worst city in the world. That's the dump of the world. Democrats have made this the worst city in the world.
But there are a lot of people who supported him there. That, you know, it's the biggest tech community. So it's the highest level of like tech billionaires you'll find in the world. You know, so there are a lot of people who are sort of the new kind of crypto class who live there. So it's not what it was. It used to be a very liberal city. I think it's changing. I think it's definitely become kind of a tech capital. So it's different.
So I lived in San Francisco from 1978 till 1980.
Mm-hmm.
It was so great. I mean, my station was in the Tenderloin district, and even the Tenderloin, which, you know, that was supposed to be where all the homeless was. You know, even the Tenderloin was good.
Yeah.
But over the years, it's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, there's a big divide between the rich and the poor. You know, in San Francisco, people are ultra rich or really poor, and that causes a lot of tension. So that's a big problem. You know, and when the city sort of infrastructure only supports the rich with these like fancy restaurants and, you know, kind of like the way that the society is, you'll find poor people really being frustrated and being pushed under, and it's really hard.
It wasn't that way in the like late 70s and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
Yeah.
And it was a delight. I mean, it was really, really something. Are you going to be working in 10 years?
Yes, I have to. I want to. I really hope I can. You know, I would love to be in every movie as the judge. I would be a good judge, like, in any film or
really?
TV show. I think so.
I mean, why don't you just go to Law and Order and say, hey, you know, put me on your next one.
Yeah.
I'm the judge.
Well, I've been it. I've done a Law and Order, but I had to be a human trafficker. But I would love to come back as a judge. That would be really, really fun.
A human trafficker, huh?
Yeah. That was fine, too. That was really cool because I got to play a real person. I love that show, too. So I love any kind of legal drama or procedural. So I would love to do that.
What was your parents' bookstore like?
It was a gay bookstore that had a lot of art books. It had a lot of gay romance novels. And we would have book signings by authors like Armistead Maupin, who wrote Tales of the City.
Sure.
You know, and things like that. So it was a very, it was like City Lights, the very famous beatnik bookstore.
Yeah.
But geared towards gay life. And I grew up there and I worked there and... you know, it was a really, really special place to be.
How do you overcome? I mean, Connie writes this in her book where she was molested by a family doctor. And you were raped by mm-hmm. family members.
When you come from that, it's really it does affect your whole life. And so you have to work on it. I've had a lot of therapy and I've had a lot of different kinds of therapy, actually, working on it. And you never really get over it, but you're able to leave it behind. You know, we can sort of package it up and leave it in a place in our lives and then maybe return to it if we need something there. But, I mean, that's the thing with trauma and dealing with it properly. There's ways to dispose, like diffuse it and dispose of it, but that never fully leaves your life. You know, I think that in a way... You know, therapies help me kind of compartmentalize it in a proper structure that helps me and can help others if I, you know, need to discuss it and want to reach out to somebody who's also enduring that kind of trauma. But it affects you your whole life.
Especially, I assume, if it's in the headlines somewhere of some story.
Yeah, well, that doesn't bother me as much because it's like I brought the story forward, you know, and I actually don't mind talking about it because that's also part of my healing is to be able to go back and refer to it. You know, like when you do enough work on yourself emotionally, it doesn't give you the same charge to go back and revisit these traumatic events. So that is the privacy element of it is not as difficult as just the fact that it exists. You know, that it exists is more like, I wonder what my life would have been like if that hadn't have happened. There would have been other trauma, something else, but that is a very specific thing.
Okay, so we're now at a place in the program, which we call the 19th hole, where you can ask me any question and I might answer truthfully.
Okay, have you seen the adorable sound where they're using sound from the Maury show? You are not the father, and it's dogs, and they're running away from the camera, and the camera, it's so cute.
I've seen that, yes. You know, and millions of views of my saying you are not the father, and these dogs start running.
It's so funny. And every time I come across one, I never skip it. And I have to send it to my friend because it was the dogs react just like the guys on the show.
Right.
They
exactly.
start running and it's yeah. so
another
funny.
Dog. Just another dog.
It's so cute. And I absolutely love that use of the sound. And I just wanted to know, where did you come up with the idea of the camera following the people on the show for that?
It's interesting. When we first did the first time I ever did a DNA story, and the producer of the particular day, and I had read all the story and the background and everything, and the producer on the, briefing me before the show would go, and here is the result. And I said, you know, I don't want to know the result. I don't want to know anything more than my guest or my audience, live audience, or my audience at home, because if I knew more than they did, I would skew my questions and it would be less than honest. So the whole inflection of you are the father, you are not the father was a very honest reaction for me because I didn't know any more than anybody else. And what happened was the reactions of the people, whether it be the woman or the guy, I mean, the director said to the cameraman, I don't care what they do, just follow them. And they would follow them backstage. And strangely enough, you won't believe this. Maybe you will. You know Tyler Perry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know the Madea series.
Mm-hmm.
So he does one of the movies in the Madea series is about whether she has picked the right husband, right, the father of a child. And so Tyler, in his huge Hollywood-like studio in Atlanta, asked me to come down there and be on the, in the movie. And he has replicated my set to a T. I mean,
incredible.
Perfectly. And so when Tyler, as Madea, finds out the guy's not the father, she runs off the stage. She collapses on the sofa behind the stage. And it was just like another show. It was remarkable.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
That is so brilliant. Yeah, because it is such a cultural, like, icon, is that DNA reveal, you know?
I know. It's been, I mean, I can't tell you how many times the show's been mentioned in rap lyrics and hip hop, and even Jimmy Kimmel, when he was having a child, and the thought that Matt Damon might be the father, and Martin Short ends up playing me coming out to give him the word. I mean,
yeah,
it's all over the place.
It's brilliant, and it's so wonderful to have this as like a cultural institution that crosses race. You know,
yes.
it crosses time, because this is it's a trope that's existed for 30 years, I
right.
think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's just strong now on social media
right.
as it was the day that you
yeah.
invented it.
And the repeats still get as good a rating as the original. I mean, it's
yeah,
it's crazy. Anyway, Margaret, you've been so dear. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being on.
Thank you so much. Such an honor.
Okay. My pleasure. Bye. If you've had as much fun as I did, make sure you subscribe to On Par with Maury Povich on YouTube and tap that little bell so you don't miss a thing. And if you like to listen on the go, we're on Apple, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast. Hit that follow button. I'll be back with more before you know it. On Par with Me, Maury Povich, is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios, with executive producers, me, Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, and Christian Thompson. Supervising producer, Mike Bournazian.